A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Moonlit musings from mums, madams, and meat packers.
Oh, never mind, I must have misheard.
The Late Night Alternative with Ian Lee.
The station's brilliant.
On Talk Radio.
There he is.
That is one of the most insane songs I've ever heard. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome the guitarist from Nicky Nacky Noo? It's Dave Hill.
Nicky Nacky Noo.
You were almost...
He's obviously checking things out.
You were going to be called Nicky Nacky Noo instead of Slade.
It was because we had this agent bloke in London, like, and he keeps saying, yeah, all right, Nicky Nacky Noo. And we're going, what the heck's Nicky Nacky Noo? I think it was one of those off-the-beam thoughts that we had occasionally in the band. Sometimes you're trying to change your name. We came to London in those days, and the studio guy said, I like the sound of you. He said, would you make an album? And he said, and we made an album for this Jack Baverstock at Fontana Records, yeah, who seemed to be quite connected as a man. He showed an interest in us. And he said, the thing is, he says, I don't like your name, you know, In-Betweens. I mean, what's the In-Betweens? Yeah. So he got a bit like that about the Nicky Nacky Noo.
I've been in bands when I was younger. Coming up with a band name is the hardest thing, because you want something that's kind of catchy, but you can say over and over again, and you don't get bored of it. How did you, because it was Ambrosia. But Dave Hill from Slade, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, in case you wondered. Ambrosia Slade, how did you come up with that and then shorten it?
Well, basically, he offered some money to members of the staff who worked at Fontana to come up with a name. And there was a woman there, apparently, who used to call things she owns by names, so she remembers them. So it could be a purse, which is Ambrose, and it could be a bag named Slade. That's the going story, and she got 50 quid. She got 50 quid, and she came up with this idea of Ambrose Slade. Jack Baverstock went for it. He said, yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's much better than the In-Betweens, you see. So, okay, fine. And then he said, but you'll never do anything with Northern management. That's what he said. He said, you need to be somebody in the business in London to actually hear you. And of course, he was right. But what we didn't realise is his connection from that time led to a connection to an agent in London.
Yeah.
I think his name was John Gunnell. John Gunnell, I think, was connected to Chaz or Stigwood, Robert Stigwood.
Yeah.
Something like, it was like a little bit of a melting pot of several.
Stigwood was the agent for the Bee Gees?
Yes, he was.
And Chaz Chandler had been in the Animals.
Yeah, I think there was a connection there somewhere. And I've never really asked Chaz precisely how he heard about us.
Yeah.
But John Gunnell met us and said, I know somebody, right? That's the way it was. I know somebody. And the somebody he knew was Chaz Chandler. Yeah. And it was like two things meeting that maybe are looking for each other. Yeah. I don't know. You know that saying, two souls that can spend a lifetime and eventually find each other? It's a bit deep, that one. But that's another side of me. But the thing is, had we not been ready, we might not have been ready to be heard by someone.
Yeah.
Prior to that, it was many years of working.
Yeah.
I'd like to point out to your listeners that this was no short-term job. This was no X-Factor.
You've been doing this for a while.
Yeah. There was no reality shows. There was no quick fixes. You've got two things in this business, mainly playing live to gather an audience, then possibly radio If you're lucky, you might get a bit of recording, if you're lucky. But most of that, it was road work, playing. Like the Beatles,
yeah,
they had to work the pubs and clubs like we did, and the Mecca ballrooms, and go to Germany, yeah, or whatever they did. But from this situation of in the studio, he got us to make an album, and we call it Beginnings, you see. And it's got a lot of extraordinary things on that album. Like,
is that the one with Martha, My Dear on?
Yes, and, yeah, with... and a Frank Zappa song,
wow,
right? You know, Ain't Got No Art. I mean, we were certainly a bit abstract.
Yeah.
We weren't a pop band. We didn't always get a lot of work because we wouldn't do chart material, yeah, you see. See, sometimes promoters in Germany would ask for a band who plays top 20 material.
Well, that was the gig in the 60s. Was a band would go and play, you know, a couple of hours in a nightclub, but you had to do all the hits from the top 20. Yeah. Maybe you could sneak in a couple of your own songs.
Yeah.
But you guys, I've got to say, Beginnings, that was the Skinhead.
No, it was before that.
Okay.
That was the Ambrose Slade. So right, we were Ambrose Slade. We got Northern Management. Then Chas heard something, and then John Gaunt said, look, I'll put him in one of my clubs in London, which was just off Bond Street somewhere. Right. It was called Rasputin. And it was one of those where you go downstairs, and there's a little stage up the corner where they're playing records. So there's a bit of a DJ, and we're stuffed up a corner, quite a small stage, very right, low. And then in comes Chas, and we see him coming down the stairs, you see, because it was only small. And we just did what we've always done. We didn't pretend to be anything other than what we were.
Yeah.
But he watched us, and he just came across and said, I want a manager. Wow. And it was like some movie clip, you know, yeah, where somebody walks in slow motion with a cigar, you know. Hi.
I'm gonna make you guys stars.
Yeah, you know, he was so enthusiastic. And one of the first things he said to me was, he said, oh, you're quite small, aren't you? He says, you're quite small. I said, yeah. He said, I think we could have a really good idea with you. We'll get the biggest guitar you could possibly get, right, and put it on you. He said, and I thought, I like this man.
He was speaking your language at that point.
We should let's get the plug in now. We're going to get plenty of plugs in. We've been talking about this book all week, Dave. You got a book out, Dave Hill. So here it is, the autobiography. This is an updated version because it came out last year, and there's an extra chapter in this one.
Yep.
We have been banging on about this all week. You very kindly brought a copy in case we didn't have one. We've got three somewhere on this premises. Mm-hmm. I've devoured it. I've read it. I've loved it. You can buy it, of course, on Amazon, the usual places. If you go, dear listener, to I've tweeted the link to the Big Green Bookshop, which I think you were at a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, it's really good,
ago,
that one.
Our mate Simon runs that, and he's got a load of signed copies. Probably not a load now, probably just a handful. But I've tweeted the link. You can get signed copies for a tenner.
Yeah, that's a good bookshop.
It's a great bookshop. Simon is a big fan of the independent bookshops. So tell us about the Skinhead phase, then, because that is for those, you know, everyone knows what Slade looked like, but the pictures of you guys with the Skinheads is a real shock to the system.
It was a shock to the system when we did it.
I bet it was.
I mean, we'd all got nice girls when we had long hair. They actually left us when we cut all our
hair. You had a posh millionaire's daughter or something.
Yeah,
I
was going out with a girl from Alton Towers, which is a big
theme park.
Yeah, I sort of fancied myself maybe marrying into the family. You know, so you'd have to correct me if I'm wrong, but I went out with a girl. She was quite posh. She sort of said things like mater and pater. You know, those
crikey, that is posh.
Yeah, yeah. And she got a sports car, and then she'd come to our humble council house and pick me up. And yes, she was quite pretty. And I met her when we did the old band. Did a show on the Alton Towers Park, you see. So, and I think we were on with a group called The Love Affair at the time, and they were really happening. And I met this girl, and she was like twiggy thin, you know. She was blonde, and I've always liked blondes. And I do remember the day I rung her to say, I've had a phone call from my manager, Chas Chandler, who's told me to get my hair cut off. He said it'll be worthwhile because I'll be a millionaire, you see. And I thought, you know, I like the sound of those. How many noughts are there in a million? And I was going, in other words, Chas was very persuasive, right? what happened about this skinhead thing, it wasn't our idea. It was our publicist, Keith Altham, and he wouldn't mind me mentioning this. Keith is a lovely man, and he's the big publicist of the time.
Yeah.
Enemy writer, he publicist to the Stones and all sorts of things he was doing. Anyway, he was our publicist, and Chaz was thinking, now, as a lot of bands were long here, I think they were just trying to figure out some way of getting us in known, you see.
Every band needed a gimmick, didn't they?
Something.
That's have something different.
So
hard.
No matter how good you were, it was trying to get an inroad somehow, you know. He was trying to think of a way to let the powers that be know about us.
I think in the book you talk about you had a casual look, so it was not unlike
the
Stones at
that time.
Well,
we looked a little bit, how can I put it? Late 60s was very much slightly flower powery, very curly, and you know, a bit sort of kind of a mixture of looking slightly feminine. And of course, the clothes were great for me. I loved all that. Kensington Market, oh yeah, we'll go there, buy the flares. And it was all like that then. And we'd come through the flower power and all that stuff, and, you know, Pink Floyd and all that. We'd come through that. And so we with Chaz, we got long hair. So, yes, we probably looked like a lot of groups as well.
Yeah.
But we looked pretty good.
Yeah.
And Keith Altham said something to Chaz. He said, oh, Chaz, you know, there's this skinhead movement. They don't have a group. He said, Chaz was going, ding. He was going, no, they don't have a group. Maybe they could have us.
Yeah.
You know, and he said, what they got to do? He said, cut the hair off. Anyway, Keith Altham said that. He said, yeah, it's a good idea. Anyway, then Keith started to get a kind of bothered about it. So he rung Chaz up again. He says, you can't do it, Chaz. He went, too late. Too late, Keith. They're down the barbers, all having their hair cut off. And Keith's going, oh, no, they'll blame me. He said, they're nice guys. You can't. He'd already done it. And I remember I went home and it was all chopped off. And Dad's looking at me, you know. And you know what? We had to go to the Isle of Arran, which took all night to get there. It's way up Scotland and it's cross on a ship to go and play. Two or three venues in the Isle of Arran, and we were scared in case any skinheads turned up and they might beat us up. You know,
look like the Bubba Boys.
I love the fact because Slade, you know, the Super Yob was. Where did the Super Yob nickname come from? Because it makes you sound like such a tough guy, and I get the vibe that you're kind of a pussycat, really.
I got a good heart. I think, yeah, I'm not. I know I was never in fights at school. I never. I didn't. I always seemed to have friends that beat people up, but I didn't have been, you know, there was always something going on. But yeah, the Super Yob is coming back to Keith Altham again.
Right.
It was him.
Yeah.
Keith figures quite a bit of my life. Keith was, it was at a time when people were called superstars or megastars.
Yeah.
And I had a number plate, right? Which was on a car I bought. Oh, it was a Sunbeam Alpine.
There we go.
And what I did not know was the number plate. I never looked.
Yeah.
I bought the car. I sold my Spitfire, little Spitfire red one. And I just bought it. And it one day I went to Solihull to do a pub. But it was a posh pub, you know. It was, hey, old boy, half a pint. And it was a little bit like that. And I parked my car. And they were all Jaguars and things. And this bloke comes on and he goes, I say, he said, Yobby. I said, what do you mean, Yobby? He said, that number page at the back of your car, Yobby. It was a bit like that, you know, some old colonel or something. And I'm going, oh, yeah, I didn't notice that. Of course, the indication of what a yob means, you see.
Yeah.
So anyway, this kind of thing stuck in Keith Altham's mind. He said, well, he had that Yob one. He said, why don't we call him Super Yob, you say? And from that idea formulated the kind of guitar that became along.
Yeah.
That I had this guitar to match my costumes and we called it Super Yob.
Yeah.
So it's become an attachment. You can see
it's there on the front, yeah.
There it is. That's That's the original one, that is, right?
Have you still got that guitar?
No. Did they I'll tell you who's got that guitar. Marco Peroni from the Adam and the Ant.
Has he really?
Yeah. He bought it out of a shop.
I wasn't expecting it going there, blimey.
Well, the reason he's got it is because I flogged it to a shop.
Right.
And that was a mistake.
Yeah, of course.
But he hasn't got it in his possession at the moment. It's actually in an exhibition in Liverpool.
Oh, wow.
Of memorabilia.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's David Supio, because that's what it is. But I had it remade by the same people.
Right.
But I put some lights up the neck, as you do. You know.
You got some
Mark
great,
two.
You got some great guitars in the '70s. I know a band that was really influenced by you. I think they ripped quite a lot off you. Were Kiss, of course, in the States.
Yeah.
And Ace Frehley kind of took the guitars to the next level. Ace Frehley, the guitarist in Kiss, would have lights that would go up and down like disco lights, and then he'd fire rockets from his guitar and stuff like that. But Kiss, I think, came and saw you when you went to the States and kind of went. Well, we can do this.
This was in the full frontal Superb days, right? And I got that guitar. And we played somewhere in New York. It was quite a New York. It was a famous venue where a lot of rock bands played. And we headed to New York because that's where the impact of the publicity was for us, you see. And LA and all those. But New York was like, oh, right, we're going to do this gig in New York, you see. So there's a funny story coming up here, which is in the book. But it was a night. I got the platforms on. They're quite high that time, and I'd got the outfit and the yob. We didn't know Kiss, and we didn't know who they were.
Yeah.
They were just in the audience. It wasn't until much later that I met Gene Simmons from Kiss,
right,
who relates the story.
Yeah,
and he got it wrong, but it sounded funny what he thought. Right, I came on the stage. And we had what you call a little walkway. You could go down the centre. You often see it now in big shows.
Yeah, yeah.
Where, you know, Mick Jagger was walking right in the middle of the audience, right? Well, we had a little walkway, you see. And I spotted that. The problem was, I was a bit enthusiastic. And I went wang down the front, you know, doing all that. And I fell. I fell on my back. And it looked like a Reeves and Mortimer sketch. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but... My boots come up. It was like, and I thought, how do I get round this?
Yeah.
And I'm going, I'm looking round, and the others are killing themselves laughing.
Oh, I bet.
So I tried to make it look I actually did it on purpose,
yes,
right?
You styled
so
it out.
Wasn't that funny? And the Kiss members bought it. Because when I saw him, he said... he comes up and he goes, you know what the Americans like? They go, Mr. Hill, awesome, you know. And they shake your hand. It's got Gene Simmons, a big tall guy. He said, I saw you in the song, it was Radio City or something like that in New York. He said, you came out to the audience and you went V sign. Right, well, I never do that anyway. And he said, you did that to the audience and then... You went on your back and kicked your legs out. I thought that was really out of sight. That's part of the act, of course, isn't it? Oh, yes, it is. Yes.
Let's take a quick break. We've got Dave Hill from Slade, not Nicky Nacky Noo, not the in-between.
No.
He's got a brilliant book, So Here It Is. It's such a cracking read. It's going to make a brilliant Christmas present. This is The Late Night Alternative with Ian and Kath on Talk Radio.
The late night lip service for lovers, loners and lounge lizards.
Yeah, well, where exactly is your accent from?
The Late Night Alternative with Ian Lee.
Oh, I've forgotten your name already, excuse me.
On Talk Radio.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, you! Are you mad for I'm a Celebrity? Are you crazy for critters? Can you not wait for the next Bush Tucker trial? Then you need to listen to Jungle VIP, the daily podcast that gives you all the goss straight from the jungle floor. I'm Jamie East, and every day I'll be bringing you reaction from the latest episode of I'm a Celebrity. I'll be talking to campmates from past series, hearing directly from the outback, and setting stars my very own Bush Tucker trials. It'll be free to listen to every single morning. All you got to do is search for Jungle VIP on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favourite podcast app. And make sure you subscribe to never miss an episode. Jungle VIP, better than eating a kangaroo's...
The Late Night Alternative with Ian Lee on Talk Radio. We'll get you talking.
We've noticed your hair's getting a bit like Ringo.
So we're just back on. Dave's telling us about when he worked for Tarmac and wasn't allowed to grow his hair.
No.
And that, would they call you in and say, come on now, Dave, you're going to have to get that chopped
off. Well, yeah, I think it was a defining moment. I'd spent 2 years there, and obviously there was some discrepancy about my spelling. You know, that certain documents were being filed under the wrong letters or something like that. There was that comment. I went to night school to improve my English. It did not improve it. And one day, I think I must have been 17, I was called in by the personnel officer, because you had one of those in those days. A personnel officer is basically, he's got some issue with you, you say. And he says...
I think it's human resources now, isn't it? HR is what personnel used to be.
It means the same thing, though. Yeah. Trouble, generally. Trouble.
He kicks off by, this is a job for life. And it was sort of like, you understand you're not doing very good at night school, and we've also noticed your hair's growing. And we also know that you play in a group. So, and you do realise that these groups don't really get anywhere. It's very rare that, you know, that kind of thing. Well, it's a point of view.
Yeah.
You know, this is a solid job, you say. And it was a kind of like, maybe that was a calling card for me, because that led to me going back to Mum and Dad, getting them together. And there's Mum who got me the job. There's Dad who's a mechanic. But they both know I'm musical.
Yeah.
And they know I'm a natural musical person. Mom, you see, father was a classical pianist, if you read the story, right? Now, I've always been melodic in my mind, in my playing. Although I'm a rock player, I'm very strong in rhythm.
Oh, there's more to it than that with you, though.
But there's a lot of... there's a lot more going on than you realise with me, which will come out one day in my own album, but... there's a lot going on with me. And Chas Chandler recognised my guitar playing as unique in itself.
I want to talk to you about the guitar playing, because I genuinely think you are one of the most underrated guitar players of all time. Because I think Slater is good as Led Zeppelin, but Led Zeppelin with his big albums band doing these long songs, and Slade, you know, you're doing these 3 minute pop songs almost. Yeah. I think the sound is as good as Led Zeppelin. I think your guitar playing is incredible. We've been playing Slade songs all week and just going, listen to this guitar bit. That song we just played, these kind of monkeys can't swing. Your guitar sound on that is ridiculously good. And I was interested to read that you're left-handed, but you play the guitar right-handed.
Yeah.
Is that partly what gets you your sound? Because that's unusual.
I say that the situation when you're 13, as I was, and you're being taught a few lessons by the biology teacher, who's a jazz guitarist, does a few lessons on the side. And he said, you know, that guitar's not very good you got, Dave. You say, well, it isn't, because it's a cheap one from Kay's catalogue, you see. And my dad won't spend too much money in case I decide I don't want to do it.
Of course.
Because that used to happen in those days. So he said, well, it's not going to help. He said, anyway, you can't play it upside down the other way around, see. I said, well, I'm left-handed. He said, well, You'll have to play it right-handed because there weren't any left-handed.
Was McCartney around at that point? Because that was... No. So this was pre-McCartney. Okay,
I've got no indication.
Yeah.
You've got to bear in mind, in those days, there weren't any guitar shops either. You might get a music shop that sold the odd drums and flutes and those dreadful recorders you have at school and bits and bobs and, you know, saxophone bits. And you got that and you might see one guitar in the wind. It wasn't like... It is now a supermarket of guitars. Yeah. It wasn't like that. Yeah. In fact, you might have to go to London to find something that would look anything like a Fender.
And also the thing as well then, that people forget, electric guitars were really new. Electric guitars hadn't been around that.
No.
I mean, when did the electric guitar, like, came out early 50s or something? It became...
Well, the guitars you saw in catalogues were like Barney Kessel or... They looked quite fat.
Yeah.
And they were like jazz guitars, you see. And they looked alien to us. To me, you know, the first guitar I saw was acoustic.
Yeah.
This young kid down by me had got this acoustic. And that's what attracted my attention. It was the oddity of it. It was like, it wasn't a piano, it wasn't a violin.
Yeah.
It wasn't a dreadful recorder or any of that.
You're very anti-recorders, I'm getting here. You don't like the recorders.
Well... The other reason I don't like the recorders is that the school teacher at junior school, the headmistress, didn't particularly like me anyway.
No.
And she certainly didn't like an educated mother writing her a letter.
Mm.
She really took umbrage.
Yeah, go and tell that story, because that's incredible.
So, oh, yeah, she didn't like that at all.
So your mum wrote a letter saying, I would like Dave...
My mum wrote letters to... I mean, she had dealings with Enoch Powell and all sorts of people in the Midlands. And Enoch knew she was a War Cabinet Minister's secretary. We didn't, because she shouldn't mention it. But he knew. And the thing is, she was cited as important, as she wouldn't have got those jobs.
Yeah.
She taught the neighbours Pitman shorthand and got them jobs, right? So you wouldn't mess around. Mom, in a sense, was someone that was educated to take notes. So she writes a letter to the headmistress.
This is great.
Yeah.
And the headmistress is called Fryer, better known as Fryer Tuck.
Bit of rhyming slang going on as well, I'd imagine.
Yeah, there was a little bit of that. I don't want to be offensive. I'm sure she's not alive now.
No.
But she received the letter and she stopped me dead in my tracks in the foyer. I'm going to school. And she said, "Boy, Hill," said, "your mother's written me a letter." She said, "Join the music class." He said, "You can't join the music class. You can't read music." And I was like, "But I'm nine, you know." I mean, it was almost like end of.
Yeah.
And it was end of, and I felt kind of empty and sort of like. I mean, Mom didn't take it any further.
That's
exactly the response. But the recorder was the thing that.
Right.
You know, that was almost like blowing a ruddy whistle.
Mm.
You know, it was slightly annoying. But there wasn't many options. It was either that or the squeaky violin, and that would be hard work. But the guitar is a tactile instrument. It was something that pop music, there was skiffle, there was Lonnie Donegan, there was Tommy Steele from Nordish, is it? North Shoreditch?
Yeah.
There was him. And he was like the pop star of the day, Tommy Steele. He was good looking, you know. And at the time, there was American music coming over, as like Paul Anka and people like that, you see. There was a lot of, you know, there was the first song, it was a Ricky Valance song called "Tell Laura I Love Her."
Tell Laura I love her. One of those tragic, isn't it? Doesn't he die in a car crash?
It's a tragic song. Yeah. Oh,
a lot of those songs.
Oh, yeah. And yes, they are a bit like "Johnny Remember Me."
Johnny Remember Me.
You know, it's and what's that? "Ebony Eyes" of the Everly Brothers.
Oh, I don't know that one.
"My Ebony Eyes." And the motorbike accident was, you remember that
Leader
one?
Of the Pack.
Yeah, Leader of the Pack.
There was a lot of people dying in pop songs.
Yeah, there was most certainly, you know, things like that. And, you know, and I don't know. It is what it is. I got the sheet music. I took the sheet music to Brian Close. And he said, "Well, look," he said, "you got a bass player, haven't you?" I said, "Yeah, he's my mate. He wants to learn bass." He said, "Well, I'll tell you what. I'll teach you, but you've got to play the guitar right-handed. Mm. She said, because there's no brainer, you've got to do that. It's because you can't play it upside down.
Yeah.
It's just not going to work. The strings are wrong one way round. He said, you'll get used to it. And he was absolutely right. I
incredible?
Did get used to it. And it's alien to go that way now.
Is it?
So,
you can't
right?
do it the other way
no.
at all.
But I've met guitar players who are left-handed, who have learnt left-handed and regret it. Right?
Why is that? What do they
well,
regret?
Well, I can only say that the business of your comment about my guitar playing and things like that, if you think about it, the left hand is the power hand, isn't it? It's not doing the rhythm.
Yeah.
The right hand's doing the rhythm with me. So the left hand is doing the guts in the strings, the bending of the notes, the rhythm of the notes, because it's all going on in the sand, and that's the way it is.
Yeah.
So it becomes the writing hand, the definitive hand to grab the neck of a guitar. And the rhythm, I wouldn't say it isn't as important. It is important, the rhythm, to be able to play good rhythm, which I can do anyway.
Yeah.
But I think there is a way that a guy used to say that my guitar playing had a wobble in it, and it's a
That's a really good description,
And he said it's the Dayville wobble.
Now, the Dayville wobble?
Yeah, Dayville wobble.
That can mean so many different things.
Most guitar players bend, if they're going to bend a string, they push it
going
up.
Going up, going up.
They push it, or they do that, you see. Mm. You'll see them doing it. I do it the other way around.
Right.
So you go, and if you listen to some of the early things, you'll hear that funny little wobble.
Yeah.
And it's just a sound. Chess Chandler picked up on that, you see. So sometimes in some of the records, it sticks out.
Yeah.
Have you heard You Keep Me Straight, You Keep Me Narrow?
Of course I have, yes. Yeah.
Well, you listen to the guitar parts in that. It's a fluid guitar
all
the way through that song, right? In a sense of the way I'm playing. You hear the things I play in that.
What is interesting reading the book is I'm always interested in how bands put the sound together in the studio. And up until Don's car crash...
Yeah.
You were playing like a live band in the studio.
Yeah.
You'd go in as a four-piece and you'd pretty much lay it down live. You say Nod's vocals, you'd do two takes maximum and that was it. And not much overdubbing, I'm guessing?
No, the principle was we'd always record together as a group.
Yeah.
In the studio, Nod in the vocal booth. And sometimes Nod's vocal at that time would be kept.
Yeah.
It would be kept from the point of view it actually might be the best one he's done.
Yeah.
Sometimes a lot of your vocalists say, oh, well, you know, I don't have to, you know, it's not the real one, you know, and they can be quite relaxed.
Yeah.
With Noddy, because he has a powerful voice, you cannot overwork that voice, you see. It's one or two takes, and if you don't get it then, it's likely not to be as good.
Yeah.
And he does that sometimes, and Chaz goes, right, I'm going to keep these vocals, and we'll look at it later. And you might find you'll have one set of vocal. He'll then probably repair the odd bit and slot it in. Because everything was on tape then, you see. It wasn't cut and paste and technology. It was technology, but it was that kind of technology. And that's the thing, is we play as a band.
And then would you overdub guitar, like more guitar parts on top of that? You'd go in.
What I do is when I play, you play to get the actual take. And then what you've got is really the drummer. The drummer is captured because you don't want to be re-recording the drummer.
Yeah, that's when it gets tricky.
And also what you've got to remember about those recordings is it starts off at one tempo, right? And at the end, it's slightly faster.
Yeah.
But you don't notice because as you listen to the record, it's moving.
Yeah.
And so naturally speaking, when you play live, you don't play quantized same. If you use a drum machine, for instance, if you use a drum machine, you can hear it's a drum machine because every bass drum is exactly the same sound.
Yeah.
A real drummer doesn't sound like that, you see. When a drummer's going boom, snare, boom, snare, the snare, every time he hits the snare, although it's a similar sound, it's not quite the same.
It's a human factor, it's not perfect.
No, and also what people need to know is when we do the choruses, you don't do one set of choruses, then copy it and paste it in another section. You do each chorus and you do the lot one by one. So when you get to the next chorus, right, it's not quite the same as the one you just heard. It's probably slightly edgier, because as you proceed through a song, it's the same with my guitar playing. I can maybe not sit at home and try and totally work out what I'm going to play. But when I play a track, as it feeds into your brain, you go in and you start. And what I can do is, or what seems to happen is, something speaks to me in a sense of what I should play and what I shouldn't play. It's like something goes...
Are you saying a lot of those solos on the record are improvised as you're doing it? You've not sat at home the night before?
I couldn't say that I didn't do that. I would say that sometimes I'm in the studio and I would say some of the things is what we call on the hoof, which means you are thinking it on the day.
Great.
Creative people are not necessarily sitting at home playing, you know the element of like... Do you practice? Well, I do, but actually that's playing.
Yeah.
You know, practicing is, do I do scales? No, I don't do scales. No I don't do scales. Because that sounds to me like, oh, pentatonic. Mixolydian. I mean, I never knew what those words were when I first... I played all those things when I was young.
But didn't know.
I didn't know the name terms. Of them. It was natural. And I don't... I mean, some people say it's a load of rubbish, you know. So technical, man, you know. But actually it doesn't speak to you. The solo you picked on earlier, the way it's... It's a feeling, you see, because you're actually putting your own personal energy into that. And it's not about going... Because there's a lot of players these days that we call them the widdly widdlies, you know. And it doesn't say anything. It blows over your head. And then you get guitar players like Eric Clapton. You get guitar players like Billy Gibbons and ZZ Top. You get guitar players like, I don't know, Paul Kossoff, you know, is long gone now. But he's more economical.
It's the gaps.
Yeah.
The gaps are what make it.
It's a bit that maybe somebody will try and play an extra note. It's the fact that he's missed that.
Yeah.
It's actually... Because... There is something that comes across, and my wife always notices in the playing. When there's a lack of it, she'll say there's not enough guitar on that.
Right, right.
Or something. And it's not that she's bolstering my ego. She's not like that.
No.
But it's something that...
Oh, I love your missus, by the way, from this book. From what I've read about her. Well, she's a superstar, she is.
Well, she's solid.
She?
And she's a black country girl, you know, that means work. You know, you grew up in factories and things
she's
like that,
great.
You know. And basically, she didn't like groups anyway. So, and she's blonde. And I met her at a time when, you know, it was all mini skirts and twiggy and all that sort of stuff, you know.
How long have you been with her? That's over 50 years, isn't it?
No, not quite that long.
Oh.
We got married in 73.
Right, okay.
So when the big year.
45.
So we went to America and got married in Tijuana, which is a dump. And $35 to get married, you know. And we didn't think we were married, but we were.
But
it was legal.
God, there's so much I want to ask you. Because I want to go back to marriage in a second. Very quickly, I just wanted the comparison of after Don had his accident, where his girlfriend was killed and his memory was was totally impacted. The way you worked in the studio then changed. And what he would do the drums on his own first? Is that how it went?
What happened with the Christmas song is after the accident, which we didn't know whether he was going to survive.
Yeah.
His girlfriend got killed. She went through the windscreen of a Rolls Royce, right? This was an horrific night.
Yeah.
I didn't quite capture the impact of it when I had the phone call, because it all came via Dad.
Mm.
And Dad's going, I heard that. And then I heard my sister scream.
Come on, mate.
And she had to ring. The girl who got killed was Carol's friend.
Mm.
And she had to ring the father to find out if it was true. She thought it was a nosy neighbour that was giving her... But this is like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
So it isn't a nosy neighbour. This is not...
Yeah.
And at first we thought he just had a bump. We didn't realise the immensity. It went from a bump to he's in hospital and his girlfriend's dead. And it's all happened so quickly. And we were number one in the charts with Squeeze Me, Please Me. We'd just done Earl's Court. We'd done all the big
ones. First band to play Earl's Court, was that right?
Not the first. Bowie was before of us.
Right, okay.
I don't think Bowie fared very well, right. But we did.
Yeah, 20,000.
And I think it was pretty remarkable. From what I heard, they laid on extra trains on the underground to cope with the fans because they're all in their glitter and top hats. It must have looked amazing, actually. 1973, can you imagine that? We'd done two London Palladiums, right? One in the afternoon and one at night. In one day, we did two shows, right? And the balconies, there was caution about the balconies then. They would never have us back because the fans were making the balconies move by bouncing, all this kind of stuff going on.
A lot of stomping.
But I mean, I don't think the Palladium were quite used to our kind of music. And in the audience was the Zulu actor, what's his name, Stanley Baker.
Yeah.
And Stanley Baker was sitting in a box watching us, you see. And Nod said, oh, over there, Mr. Zulu. You know, I can imagine, can't you, Mr. Zulu. Everyone was all scared of him, you know, Mr. Zulu. You know, but because we'd worked for Stanley Baker at Lincoln Festival when he actually put us on as an outsider group, which actually we sold the festival. We went down so well that it suddenly made a mark in the newspapers.
Yeah.
So we cited Stanley Baker as being a little bit of good luck for us, you know. He put us on. It was raining all the time. And when we went on, it stopped raining. And everybody was jumping around and we got them going.
Yeah.
And he come on stage and I was chucking glitter at him, you know. It was really funny. But moving on, I tend to sidetrack. What was the first question?
We were talking about the horrific car accident and how and just...
Oh, yeah, you were talking about the drum kit. Well, what happened was we went to New York and Chaz thought, well, maybe we could do the odd show with Don and see how he fares. Because what had happened with the accident, the bang on the head caused him to have a memory problem, right? And he still has a memory problem to this day, but it's not as bad.
Right.
But it created a concussion.
So he couldn't remember what he'd done the day before.
He didn't
remember. And he couldn't remember the hits.
Well, he couldn't remember the girl that got killed either.
Really?
And in fact, the girl he thought about was his old girlfriend before it. So, he didn't know he couldn't taste. He didn't know he couldn't smell either. Yeah. And we didn't know that until later when we found out he'll never have that back, right? The memory thing was a point where he rings you and goes, what time we're leaving? 10 minutes later, it's done. What time we're leaving?
Oh, mate.
Then again, and you reach a point where you have to back off it.
Yeah, of course.
Because it's quite intense. Because Don... It's a bit, Don's, each day is like Groundhog Day to Don.
Yeah.
In other words, it's a new day. I mean, he had to write in those days what he was going to wear the next day and what he where he was going.
Man.
So imagine that. We're in New York, right? And this is something that really is remarkable. We're in New York. John Lennon cancels some studio time at the record plant.
Yeah.
The record plant is the top studio in New York, right? Chaz said, we've got some free time, he said. And he knew about the Christmas song. He knew there was this idea, but he hadn't heard it.
Yeah.
So. He said, Chaz says to us, we were doing it. He said, why don't we go in, get Don on the kit and record this Christmas song? So it was going to be a bit of a therapeutic job, you said.
Yeah.
So what we do, we go in together normally and record. We didn't do that this time because he wouldn't get through the song for a start, right? Because he might get partway and stop. Anything could happen. So what we did, which we never do, is we rebuilt the kit.
Right.
We got the theory of the song, but none of us really knew the song very well. Jim said, this is the chords. Nod's got the lyrics. And a lot of things you hear on the record were thought up on the day or the week.
Isn't it funny to think of a time when even Slade didn't know the Merry Christmas, everybody? Isn't it funny?
Nobody knew that we were creating a phenomenon, but bearing in mind we were huge then and probably the biggest band in Europe. And really, we'd had tragedy.
Yeah.
And that tragedy had knocked some wind out of us, you know, because we were all this before that, right? It was all, come on, feeling noisy. You know the kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was all, you know, squeeze me, please me, and all that. Anyway, And so we'd already had two straight to number ones. We're in New York, we're recording it. Then we started to overdub the things. Then we replaced some of the kit. And then Don plays this shuffle, which is a characteristic thing he does on records with Slay. And that really worked. And he wasn't losing it at all. He might be asking you the same question every half an hour, but he did it. We completed it, never heard it mixed, you say. Yeah. We did all the backing vocals in the corridor where the office people were coming in. And
in the middle of summer, I'm guessing.
Yeah, in the middle of summer. It's 100 degrees outside, and they're thinking these are a bunch of lunatics from England singing about Christmas.
Yeah.
And they're going to work in the offices, you say. And you imagine these buildings in New York. They're monsters, these buildings. So we're doing that. Then we leave it, and then we walk away, and I think we did one or two shows, you see. And then we went back to England. Chaz took the tapes and took them to England to work on them with an engineer at Olympic Studios, where he always did Slade Records. And they mixed it, right? And it wasn't until... I don't think we'd even heard it, actually. I think it wasn't until we were in Belgium, right? And we were doing some promotion. And the premise of this song was coming out. And then we got a phone call from the record company. And there's this sort of... sort of. It sounds a little bit French to me. Like, Slade, what a marvellous record, he said. I've just received this record from England, he said. I think it's wonderful. He said, this is just right for Belgium, and the fans will love it. Come into the office and we'll have some champagne. Well, this is 9 o'clock in the morning, right? And we just had breakfast. And it's like, and of course, we're quite comical, like, ooh, let's pop down and have some champagne, don't we? You know, it was a little bit like that. So we all went in, and we got the wives with us. I got my wife with me, and because they were with us, you know, we were doing the tour. And he puts it on, you see, and we're listening, going, "Oh, yeah, oh, yeah." And so we haven't really heard it, you know. It's it sounds pretty good. Champagne. Martin Shannon comes out, you know, bubble wobble. More champagne? Yeah, more champagne. We'll play it again. And then, by the third time he played it, we were smashed. and we're all going, yes, it does sound good. I think you're right. You know, it's a little bit like that.
Yeah, of course.
And then when we got back to England, obviously we'd spoke to Chaz, and Chaz said, phew. Radio One's going crazy about it. It was all a bit like that. And the record company's doing their pieces about it. And we got home. And I went up to Solihull, where I lived, and he rung me, Chaz, and he said, are you sitting down, man? I said, what do you mean? He said, 500,000 records have gone out today.
Wow.
500,000 records now. We're keeping the charts for 20 years.
Those numbers.
Never mind.
It sounds crazy, those numbers.
You know, and it was like 500,000 records, you know. It was almost like a firecracker, you know. Mm. It was like, do you know, you cannot stop the river pushing.
Yeah.
And it was just something like a force of nature, that something made a direct connection with the public in 1973, when there was 3 day strikes, 3 day working hours strikes, tellies went off at 10 o'clock.
Oh, it was grim.
People, and it was probably worse than Brexit,
yeah,
if it can get much worse than that. But it was that kind of, like, a bit despondent, a bit sort of, and then this record comes out, and it hit the, I think it's because it's so damn British, and I think it's so in your face, not Jingle Bells, it's not about that, it's about exactly what you do at Christmas, right? The family coming around, the granny line about the old song.
It's genius. It's simplicity.
But that's so simple. And Nod actually went down to his dad's council house and had a few beers and wrote those lyrics, right? That's exactly what happened. He goes there and he writes a lyric. I think he had a spontaneity moment. But he wrote the lyrics, I think, in a sense of not listening to Jingle Bells or you know, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, because that's the idea of the songs. When the granny said to Nod, or said to Jim, I think it was, no one writes Christmas songs. They're all the same old ones, wonderful as they are, right? Because it used to be all the Ronettes and all them songs.
Oh, the Phil Spector album.
Or it was Dean Martin or it was Bing Crosby. Those were the Christmas songs of our era. But this was a rock song by a rock band, and it was like, what is this? And no other record, even though Roy Wood had got a really good song, which he had, I think he would have been one if ours hadn't have come out. I'm sure of that. But Roy's is a very good record, but ours, the difference between a number two and a number one is vast.
Yeah,
I don't know if you know that.
Yeah.
But it's not like, oh, there's a few more copies, you're number one. No, there's not. It's like hundreds of thousands more copies are going out. But they run out, typical British, they run out of records, right? They had to import them from Germany. got the demand. They run out of records. But it was number one, I think the first 2 weeks in January, still number
one. Still going on.
But nobody was thinking the following year or the year after. And crikey, was anybody thinking of 45 years later?
Oh, it's nuts.
You know, people have come and died since then. People have happened and died since those days.
Dave, listen, I have to go to the news. Can you stick around? Do you mind sticking around for another 20 minutes? Or if you've got to shoot off, you shoot off. Can we have another 15?
As long as you get me home.
We are getting you a cab, sir. Can we keep you till 11:15? Would you mind?
Yeah, as long as I can get back to the hotel about 12.
You'll be back before then. Bless you, Dave. Thank you so much. Because I've not asked you about Flame. We've not talked about your, you know, you talk about mental health a lot in the book. We've got Dave Hill from Slade. Brilliant guitarist. The book is So Here It Is. It's out now in paperback. If you've got the hardback, get this one as well, because it's got an extra chapter.
Yeah.
If you get it from Big Green Bookshop, you can get it signed. You can get it in all the usual places.
Well, you can.
It's a cracking read.
And you can get a silver copy from... It's a... Silver is the only one in Sainsbury's.
Oh, okay.
Sainsbury's have got an exclusive on this
brilliant.
Book. So it's in about 80 stores up and down the country
selling
the silver version. So they slightly altered it with the name on the top and one thing or another.
Limited edition. So honestly, it was make...
And I suppose you've noticed the quote from Noel Gallagher.
Yeah, I want to work... No Slade equals no Oasis.
Yeah, that's...
I'm not a fan of Oasis, so maybe we need to talk about that.
Well, it's purely the fact that he said it. Yeah. I mean, I didn't put those words in his mouth.
Listen, we're going to have a quick break. We'll come back in a minute. We've got some more Dave Hill. This is the Late Night Alternative on Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Talk Radio. We'll get you talking.
We've got Dave Hill from Slade for another 10 minutes or so. The book is brilliant. So Here It Is. It's his autobiography. You can get it from Big Green Bookshop. Get it from Amazon. There is a special edition only in Sainsbury's with a silver cover if you want something a bit special. I tell you, what's really interesting, Dave, you write... This touches on a lot of stuff that I wasn't expecting from you. The first chapter about your mum. God, your mum had a life, didn't she? The stuff she went through, that poor woman, with your elder sister, you know, the whole thing of having a what we used to call an illegitimate baby, a baby out of wedlock, the shame that was kind of the young women suffered at that point. And you speak very openly about your mum's struggles and your mum's mental health. She was... she was a remarkable woman, it sounds like, who went through a lot, didn't she? She struggled a lot.
Yeah, she's... it's a difficult thing because there were incidents at home which were unpleasant. I mean, when I was old enough to notice, that's when I noticed.
Yeah.
So when you're really young, stuff happens, doesn't it, you know? They found some letters in Dad's council house upstairs, and the letter was Mom writing to her sister, and she was talking about ending it, and I was only one. She said if it wasn't for David, it was just, she said sometimes, it was just a comment. I'm not saying she meant it, you know, because she'd had me, right, before she had my sister. But the first time I noticed it was she used to seem to be unhappy when we went on holiday. She was more happy when she was working in the office, as if busyness maybe covered up the thoughts of what was really going on. I'm sure she would have wanted to end the pregnancy of the child out of wedlock. Mm. I'm sure of that. Because of the family she came from, in a sense of high church people. Granddad was the organist at the church.
Right. And a very well-to-do family as well,
yeah,
weren't they?
I think they got a car.
I know, I love the fact that in those times, yeah.
Talking about 1920, 30s, yeah, yeah. You know, and Mom as a child. I don't know exactly how it was hidden or how it was coped with. All I know is that Mom had a companion for Jean, that's the child. Mm. No one knows who the father is, but we suspect it could be somebody in politics, somebody important maybe she worked for, I don't know. He was certainly married.
Mm.
There is nothing on the birth certificate. But if you kind of work it out, you can work it out as you get older, because you start to sort of think, oh, I can see now what was going on. When I went in search of a relation who was the son of my mom's sister, he made a point of saying to me, the pregnancy at that time was absolute taboo. It was bad enough in the 50s to become pregnant and not married. But in the 1920s and 30s, the sin and guilt of punishment was another word that I heard. You know, anything that went wrong, I suffer slightly this problem myself, is if you think you do something which you don't think's good, it might reflect an outcome to something else. For instance, it's almost like you better be good, else nothing's going to be good for you. Well, that actually is totally untrue, but unfortunately, when you're depressed, it becomes almost fact to you.
Yeah, of course it does.
And with Mom, I remember something where I think there have been one or two incidents, but this one in particular I remember, is I broke a window over the road. I threw a brick at some kid, I suppose, and it went in and bust a window. Now, the next thing I know is I'm in bed. Dad's coming home. You know the kind of thing. Your father will be back and all that. And what I don't realise is she puts a scarf around her neck and lies on the floor with an empty bottle of pills.
Oh.
And it's a whole epic of a drama. I don't know what's going on in the other room, except I hear Dad coming up the stairs. Get up, you silly bugger. Right, and I'm going, what do you mean, get up, you silly bugger? And there's these pills on the floor. She was looking like she committed suicide, you say. So that's only a small part of it, you say. But that, you can't sort of figure out how that can be. When you've
how
got
old
a,
were you, sorry, when that? When you? When
oh,
that happened?
Probably about eight,
right,
nine.
So,
and
so, yeah, young.
That's when you start to know, isn't it? That's when you start to, when you're seven, you start to be sensitive to a lot of things.
I think you're right, yeah.
The outside world becomes a little bit more scary. Mm. And I think little incidents like that. And she came in one day and stuck a diploma on the wall of Granddad's, because he was a doctor of music, you see. Mm. And she put it on the wall and said, he's a good man. Well, he was a good man. And I'm sure he was a good father to my mom. But as the relation said, he said, your mom being pregnant at that time was absolute taboo, and it would have actually been a shame. So,
sorry, the implication of her putting up that certificate, you said, mentioned in the book, you take that as a criticism of you, saying he this was a good man and you're not.
Do you know, I could never have asked her that question.
Yeah.
At that age, you can't even reason on it. It was a reflection that she had a problem.
Mm.
And her father was seen as something that was good, but she'd done something which wasn't
right.
Good, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, Jean was alive then, you see, and Jean was the daughter.
This was your older.
Yeah, she lived sister. Just in the flats around the corner, you see.
And you guys at the time didn't know about her.
I didn't know quite. Yes, I didn't know.
You did at that point, right?
I didn't know that it wasn't Dad's daughter.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Right. I didn't know Mom and Dad weren't married either. I didn't know about the fake wedding there.
Yeah, fake wedding?
Yeah,
again,
fake.
To avoid the
Once
shame.
Again, yeah, it was to make an honest woman of her and probably make things look right for Jean, you know?
And they faked it by going to a registry office
with
friends and family, going in without them, then coming out saying...
Coming out with
married.
A ring, yeah, and going, yes, incredible. This is all fine. Of course, Dad's married, you see,
yeah.
And his wife won't divorce him, but you won't have his children, are they? So I if you picture the story, almost like a kind of war drama, where there's two people, right? Mom's in the office, dad's on the shop floor. Mm. It's an underground factory, ammunition factory, I say. I assume mom's not working for the war cabinet minister then. She's working in an office, right? And I guess mom's fairly pretty. She sees dad and they meet, and dad's a bit of a dapper guy. You know, he may be a mechanic, but he knows how to dress.
Yeah.
And he's something happens there, and it's quite romantic. So I think they're kind of locked together. And bearing in mind, dad didn't even know mom had got a child then, you see. Except that he noticed she'd keep disappearing to go and make a phone call. And he followed her one day and said, "Who are you ringing?" Because he thought she was having an affair, which she wasn't. She was ringing her daughter. So that came out.
Families are.
It's interesting, but kind of if you look at the way they make dramas now, you can imagine going back to that time, you know, where I remember when mum went to work, they wore sort of slightly shouldery suity type. Mom was very smart, going to work, office. She was fine. And we were latch kids, latch door, you know, the latch key kids. So therefore, we were at school. We had to go to someone's house until mom got back from work. But mom was okay there, and that was okay. But these incidents were little spots of time in my life where there were indications of something on a deeper level. What we didn't know is that characteristic of something going wrong. I think that the worst thing that really happened was the loss of Jean, because
she died, didn't she, very young?
But there's a story behind Jean which also is damaging. Jean was born with a Fitz problem,
right?
Now, whether mum attempted to abort the child, I don't know really what happened. Mum might be blaming herself that she's having fits because of something mum did. So I don't know. She's not alive for me to ask her.
Yeah.
Right? But I'm trying to figure the story in a sense that she was carrying this. So if anything goes wrong at any point, it's connected. Mm. Or it could be. Now, you see a woman on the one end who's teaching the neighbours. You know, I've seen the neighbours and they've done little stories for the book, you know. Oh, your mum was a wonderful woman. She got my daughter a job and teached her to, you know, she was like that. And she wrote letters for the neighbours to official people. Like,
she'd make phone calls for them as well because people didn't know how to use phones.
No, they didn't have
job.
A phone anyway.
Yeah, so she would make phone calls because she knew what to do. I love that.
And so she's a good... She really is a good woman.
She sounds it.
And she's a good mom.
Yeah.
When I got into trouble once, because me and my mate got into school once at night, right, and it's a commonly known story.
Yeah.
But we weren't causing damage. We got through the window and went and played football in the gym, you know, and had a laugh, you see. And then, one thing or another, and then somebody else broke in. And something happened before, and then there was a police incident and an inquiry, and we got in trouble, see. And Mum was sharp, you know. And
sharp,
can you
it.
Vision this story? I'm in senior school, right? And the police come, the detectives come. And the headmaster has me sat in the room, and there are two detectives there, right? And they're asking me questions, right? Now, do you see something wrong there?
Well, yeah, you're a kid being interviewed by the police. Yeah.
Mom knew that.
She spotted it.
Oh, yeah. She was on to the chief of police. She said, "Yes. How dare you interview and question my son?
Yeah.
He's underage for a start." She knew the law. Because she was clever. So she was on it right away. And be honest with you, I think that's basically what smoothed it down.
Yeah.
But she knew the chief of police anyway, because it was just a question of a phone call. But she was quite correct. The headmaster of the school, and I won't mention the school.
No.
I won't mention the school. I think he was going to be moved to a grammar school. And he was a strange-looking fellow, so I won't tell you who he looked like. We had some jokes about that. And he used to wear... And he used to wear a cape and walk around, like, and he kept fetching me out of class, going, "What's your mother doing?" you know, I thought he was going to whack me.
He was terrified that
she had him rattled.
He said, "Your mom, what did your mom say?" I don't know what she said. You know, I don't know the policeman, you know. But it was a defining moment in my life. I'd got into trouble, and Mum would probably say, I had to tell Mum and Dad I'd sneaked into a school, right? And Dad goes, "What do you mean you sneaked into a school?" I said, "Me and Tony sneaked into a school." "You sneaked into a school?" He said, "Yeah." And the police are coming round later on. Can you imagine me telling them that? The police are coming round, the Mum's going, and they didn't turn up.
Yeah.
And she said, "The police, and they've interviewed you." And she was on it. The next day, crows were flying. And then eventually it led to us going up to the police place and saying, "Well, have you learnt a lesson, boy?" "Yes, I've learnt my lesson. I won't do it again. No, I won't do it again." We hadn't done anything that bad. but the point is, it was all part of a syndrome. So, OK, we got over that. Then they come to visit me many weeks later, and I was kind of sheepishly going to the door. "Hello, coming in." And it was a bit sort of like, "Oh, your son, Mrs. Hill, looks like he's changed. You know,
he's learned his
looks
lesson.
Like he's changed." It's just like I was trying to be a goody-goody. But I tell you one thing, my mom didn't stop me playing with the boy that went in that school with me. Because in a way, we were bored. And I think when we found something, I found something that worked for me, I focused all my energy into that guitar. And I think that's been my saviour through a depression, through stroke.
Stroke on stage.
Wow. Depression, serious depression I had. See, a lot of people think I don't have a bad day because I always look happy. I am a happy person. I've got a great wife. I've got 5 grandkids. I've got a lot of nice things. And people say, "Oh, I bet you're really rich." And I said, "Well, actually, I'm not rich in money." I said, "I've never earned that much money out of this." I said, "But I'm rich in family, and that's more important." I know, in a sense, and that's what's in the story, is actually how I look at things in the light of all things, the bigger picture. I mean, I got into Wordsworth a few years ago, and I read a thing called Lines Written Above Tintern Abbey, and it spoke to me about nature, and it spoke to me in a different way about how to view maybe what we're doing here, why are we here, in a sense of not this archetype of sort of, not that I don't have faith in God. I'm not saying I don't disbelieve.
Well, you hint in the book, you've been on kind of a spiritual journey.
Yeah,
I've been,
in a sense, the music we do is spiritual as well, because I think it's uplifting, it does things for people, and it does things for me, and my reaction with the audience. You know, we're doing that gig in London at the Ulu University. I mean, when we play there, there is a spirit taking place and a sense of happiness, and
music,
they feel good, I feel good, we're into play, you see. So actually, even when I was suffering depression, my psychiatrist, who eventually got me well, said, "There's one thing you did, and it was a good job you didn't stop doing it, is you dragged yourself on stage and played." Because when you play and inject endorphins into you, you're great for that time, but the next day you're back to square one.
Dave, we need to let you go because your missus is going to be furious.
I know,
with us.
I know.
Listen, very quickly, just say, I was so pleased as well to see that Nod's written the foreword to this.
Yeah,
you guys all right now?
We've always been all right. You get kind of comments in every band when bands split up.
Oh,
they're all arguing. No, we're not all arguing. Basically, Nod had had enough and wanted to come away from it totally.
Yeah.
And he's chose his path. My thoughts on Nod and Jim, although they're not with me now, is I see Nod frequently.
Really?
Right?
Good.
Comes down to see me. And I did say to him one day when he came down, I said, "Hey, would you like to do a forward? The book company have asked." And he said, "Yeah." He said,
"Brilliant.
I'll write all the jokes about it, you know, or something really funny." But actually, he's a thinking man. Yeah, and he went away and he made the comments about the guitar playing.
Yeah.
And when I offered him the job in the band and 3 lead guitarists and all that kind of stuff, he mentions that. And obviously, Noel Gallagher's comment is only because I ran into Noel Gallagher at the airport.
Did you really?
Terminal 5. And he just came and he said, I'm a fan. And I said, I'm aware of that. He said, because I knew he liked How Does It Feel. And I said, it's a great song. Anyway, they done come on Feel the Noise. So I was aware of Noel. He's a nice guy.
Yeah.
And we just exchanged the odd text on the phone, you see. And then one day I just said, would you like to do a few words about you and Liam growing up in council houses watching Top of the Pops?
Yeah.
And he did. It's precisely Brilliant. What he said. And I didn't tell him what to say. He says what he says.
Yeah.
No Slade, no Oasis. I mean, I didn't expect that. That was rather nice.
That's a great line, isn't
but
it?
It's also... to Noel, I suppose what he's saying is that this is the truth.
Yeah.
This is, it's a bit like what the Beatles did for me, you know. Okay, Hank Marvin was everything at one time, but the Beatles in 1963, and I turn professional, right? And I grow my hair, and I feel more confident, and Mum and Dad go, give it a go, son.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I did.
Dave, you've got to go. Jan is listening to
and
this.
And I better go.
For God's sake.
Yes,
this is, listen, the book is it's a real joy. Dave Hill, so here it is. You get it from place you usually get books, Amazon, all those places. If you go to Sainsbury's. Was it
Sainsbury's? So it's in Smith's as well. In
Sainsbury's
the casual.
Got the silver cover. It,
and the silver cover is a special one for Sainsbury's that wanted an exclusive cover.
And it's, honestly, it's a great book.
But it's got an extra chapter about 1973 and beyond. And I think you might get the way I've been talking tonight, you might get the idea of what it's really all about when you go through the whole lot, is that everybody has problems and everybody has things to share. We're not that far different from each other in life. We all have gifts in different ways and we all do what we do. But basically, we're all serving each other in this life. And if you find something that does some good, as I did, then if you believe in it, do it.
I love you, man. I genuinely love you. Thank you so much for the music. Seriously, thank you. This is Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. Contact Talk Radio. Call 0344 499 1000. Text Talk and your message to 87222. Text costs 25p plus your standard network rate. Or you can tweet us at Talk Radio.
Talk Radio.
We'll get you talking.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.